coming to you from the hills overlooking beautiful and picturesque Monterey Bay, and bringing you the news behind the news, the story behind the story, hoping to convince you that reality is usually scoffed at. Illusion is usually king. But in the battle for survival of Western civilization, it's going to be reality, not illusion or delusion, that's going to determine what the future will bring. I need to remind you the views that are expressed here are not necessarily those of the owners, management, staff, sponsors, or supporters of the station you're listening to. They're my views, the views of our guests, the views of our callers, and of course we welcome your calls from out across America at 1-888-24-LIBERTY, that's 1-888-24-LIBERTY, or here in the Central Coast of California at 464-8295, but please hold your calls for the time being. We have with us on the line David Osinski. We're going to be talking about his book, Polio, An American Story. David, thank you so very much for being with us.
My pleasure.
Well, what motivated you to write the book?
Well, I am of that age, Dr. Stan, where I was one of the first kids who was lined up and given the 3 salt polio vaccine shots. So I can very well remember in the era of the early 1950s how the polio plague would come each summer and how swimming pools would be closed and bowling alleys would be closed and local newspapers would run daily box scores of how many kids came down with polio, and you were told the do's and don'ts of whom you could play with and whom you couldn't, and life really changed, and it was scary. And I often tend to write about things I remember, and the fear of polio and also the great celebration once the vaccine arrived are things I remember very well.
And I think, of course, it's an amazing story of two scientists, Jonas Salk and, of course, Sabin, Albert Sabin, and their race to come up with a viable vaccine. Really one of the great accomplishments of modern times, isn't it?
It is. They were in competition, Salk having his killed virus polio vaccine and Sabin his live oral polio vaccine. And it really was a race in which these two guys did not like each other and were very public about their feelings. On the other hand, what they really did was they both worked for the March of Dimes and got big grants that were given by the March of Dimes through very small contributions from millions of people around the country. And they basically worked on a vaccine with building blocks provided by other scientists. And the March of Dimes had promised a vaccine basically to end polio and made good on that promise, and Salk and Sabin were the two men who largely did it.
And of course, I think most of our listeners probably never knew about FDR, that he had polio, and because his severe crippling disease, he formed the March of Dimes, didn't he, really? And this was really one of the few great things I think he really did.
Well, that is true. He got polio in 1921 at the age of 39, which was very unusual. Polio is largely a children's disease. It was called, in fact, infantile paralysis. And once Roosevelt got it, what he did was to spend a large part of the rest of his life looking for the cure. You know, he went down to Warm Springs, Georgia, bathed in the waters, started the March of Dimes, really became sort of the symbolic figure behind it. And it was Roosevelt who got this organization going, and the March of Dimes, or the National Foundation for Infantile Paralysis, was in fact the greatest voluntary philanthropic organization of the 20th century. It was quite extraordinary. Roosevelt, obviously, when he went into politics, turned the reins over to others, but he was the sort of the founding father behind it.
And I can still remember, of course, in all the stores that have a big jar there, yes, something, a March of Dimes on it, you'd a slot in the top of the cover, and you'd put your money in, and they'd pass those things around at theaters just to raise money. They did an amazing job to raise the money, to raise the funds, to come up with an amazing vaccine. Of course, there are some problems, but still, from a scientific point of view, it pretty well did away with the poliomyelitis here
did.
In this country.
In the United States, it did. It was one of the great medical success stories of the 20th century.
All right, we're going to be back here in just a couple of moments with David Osinski, and I think you'll find his story fascinating, the competition and how this all came about. Well, this is Dr. Stan here at Radio Liberty, coming to you from the hills overlooking beautiful and picturesque Monterey Bay. Our guest this afternoon is David Jasinski, and he's written a fascinating book entitled Polio, an American Story, The Crusade That Mobilized the Nation Against the 20th Century's Most Feared Disease. And David, of course, was saying that because he was young enough to remember when he had to stand in line to get the Sabin vaccine. But, of course, as you point out in your book, although there was a great deal of fear that was associated with polio, it certainly was not killing as many people as many other accidents or automobile accidents or other things. But there was a tremendous fear associated with this disease.
That's a very, very good point. In terms of childhood cancer, accidents, the number of kids who died from diarrhea and influenza. Polio was not all that common. But as you know, Dr. Stan, it's a very visual disease. You see kids in leg braces, you see kids on crutches, you see kids in iron lungs. And it was a disease against which there was no protection. You know, there was no cure and there was no way to protect your child. And therefore it caused a panic. And I'd say, at its height, there were about 50,000 cases a year. About half of them wound up to be paralytic, and some children did die. But it really was, I think, the March of Dimes advertising this disease in ways that clearly were revolutionary and that changed the way that other philanthropies now work. They were the ones who began using poster children. They began using lots of celebrities. They began the Mother's March against polio. You know, today there are marches against virtually every disease and poster children for virtually every disease and celebrities on board for every disease. This was begun by the March of Dimes, so it was very adept at creating the publicity that turned this into a national crusade.
And it really became a crusade, and everybody was really following this thing. And, of course, there was a race between Dr. Jonas Salk and then, of course, Sabin. Salk being at Cincinnati and Sabin being, where was he?
Actually, Salk was in Pittsburgh and Sabin was in Cincinnati.
Right, okay.
Right.
And of course, so why don't you give a little of the background? Because one of the things they did was they did massive testing on this thing before it was ever released, and part of it was done here in America, part of it was done in Russia.
That is right.
How did they ever get the Russians to go along with allowing them to test an American vaccine on millions of Russians?
It's in my book. It's a very interesting story. This was a time, Dr. Stan, when the government played no role, really, in the testing of biologics, you know, vaccines or drugs. And it was the entire process of testing.
Hold that thought right just a moment.
Sure.
We're going to bring some other stations on here. Well, this is Dr. Stan, and our guest this evening is David Jasinski. We're talking about his book on polio. And we were talking about, of course, the time when, before they could actually start giving shots or the sugar cube to everybody, why they had to test them. And, of course, Jonas Salk had an injectable vaccine, and Sabin had the oral vaccine. But how are they going to get them tested and mass testing to find out if they were safe? So why don't you tell the story?
I will. This was an era before the government really became involved, and a lot of the early testing would be done on children in mental hospitals and orphanages. I mean, there were no ethics committees of universities to get through and no Food and Drug Administration to send protocols to. So basically, they were on their own. And in 1954, finally, when they thought the vaccine was safe enough for mass testing, the March of Dimes really encouraged public schools throughout the United States to take part, and more than a million children were lined up and either given the Salk vaccine or a placebo to see whether it worked. And nobody knew whether it worked. Nobody really knew how safe it was. And I think it's a measure, Dr. Stan, of how frightened people were of polio that my mother, who counted every aspirin that our family took, lined me up for three polio shots, you know, that had in no way been tested much beyond the March of Dimes. When Salk's vaccine was successful, and it was declared successful and safe, Sabin then realized he could no longer test in the United States because too many kids had already been given the Salk vaccine. And Sabin asked for permission in the late 1950s to go to the Soviet Union to test. The Russians were having a very serious polio problem, and they were not happy about admitting it, but they were willing to allow Sabin to come in and to test. And Sabin actually tested on 70 million children.
70 million Russian children.
70 million. As Sabin later said, there's no better place to test than the Soviet Union. It's like a captive population.
Well,
that's the way he was right.
Right. And, of course, what they really found that was even a more effective vaccine, wasn't it?
It was. It was, Dr. Stan. The Sabin vaccine produced, it's a live virus vaccine. So the Sabin vaccine, they actually take live poliovirus and they weaken it to the point where it will cause a natural infection in the body, but not full-blown polio, and therefore a lifetime of immunity. So when you take that Sabin sugar cube, you should have a lifetime of immunity. The only problem is that it's a live virus vaccine, and in a very, very small number of cases, one in a couple of million, it can cause polio in the person taking the sugar cube.
Or it can go wild, and so often what happens is the mother taking care of the child or taking the vaccine,
exactly.
Of course, the organism would become virulent again and infect the mother. But we're talking about six or eight cases
in
the entire country. Whereas before that we'd had tens of thousands of cases. So this really, in many respects, was a great, great advantage.
Well, yes, the Sabin vaccine was probably in that way the better vaccine, and that is the vaccine that's being used in developing countries today because it's so much easier not to use needles, so much easier just to give a single sugar cube or a little liquid in the mouth than it is to give a series of injections. On the other hand, Dr. Stan, by about 1990, the only kids getting polio in the United States were those taking Sabin's vaccine. In other words, they were getting it directly from the vaccine. So in the year about 2000, the CDC in Atlanta recommended going back to the Salk vaccine in the United States. So kids today in the United States are taking the Salk vaccine.
But, of course, the Salk vaccine really isn't anywhere near as effective as the Sabin, is it?
It is now. Now it's been juiced up, and it does give long-lasting immunity. And the beauty of it is that if it's properly created, it cannot cause polio. In other words, because the poliovirus is dead, it's been killed in that vaccine. So it cannot cause polio. And what happens is the Sabin vaccine got the numbers down, as you mentioned, to 10, 12, 15 a year, and now they decided to go back to the Salk to completely wipe polio out in America. So the Salk vaccine is used in the United States.
All right. Well, of course, you at one point in your discussion, you talk about the simian virus 40, because of course that was a sort of a dark cloud that hung over this whole vaccine experiment, and because it was really a massive experiment. And of course, the average American has never heard of simian virus 40. Would you like to talk a little bit about that?
Yeah, sure. Dr. Stan, when poliovirus was used, they had to find a source for poliovirus in order so that it could be used in a mass-produced vaccine. And they actually produced the poliovirus in monkey kidney tissue. And what happened is that, you know, in the 1950s and 60s, they didn't know a whole lot about simian viruses or monkey viruses. And it was very possible that viruses were getting into the polio vaccine because it was grown in monkey tissue that researchers like Salk and Sabin had never even heard of. And SV40 is one. And the reason it's called SV40 is that it was the 40th simian virus to be discovered in the polio vaccine. Now, SV40 was shown to cause cancer in lab rats, in lab animals, but it has never been shown, demonstrated carefully, to cause cancer in humans. So it's still an open question, but the evidence seems to be overwhelming that it's always risk-reward, but it's better to take the polio vaccine than not to take it.
Well, okay.
There'll always be risks, and SV40 is one of those risks, but it's never proven to be carcinogenic in humans. Although, you know, it certainly needs more study, and it's getting more study.
Well, my understanding, of course, is they changed from the rhesus monkey to the green monkey so that you wouldn't have the simian virus for
it. Right, and after about 1970, they were good enough so that they could actually test out these viruses. But in other words, Dr. Stan, this was, SV40 was a virus that appeared, you know, in other words, I'm sure I may have gotten it in the original Salk vaccine. So from 55 till about 1970, involving, you know, the inoculation of millions of kids, SV40 was probably in that vaccine.
All right, fine. Of course, this is still something that is very much a concern to to many people, because we've got literally millions of people out there that actually carry the simian virus 40 in their bodies today.
Right, that is correct, and more study is needed. To this point, the studies that have been done seem to show that there is no danger in humans, but it's still an open question.
Now, did you ever study what happened in Boston when, of course, the people in Boston, they hated Jonas Salk, so they weren't going to use his vaccine because they were waiting for Sabin's vaccine to come along. And, of course, I was practicing medicine at that time. At least I was going to medical school. And so they wouldn't allow the immunization of the people or vaccination of people in Boston. Do you remember that story? Did you ever get that?
Well, what I do remember is that in 1955 and 1956, there were very serious polio outbreaks in Boston.
Right.
And one of the reasons appeared to be, right after the Salk vaccine was declared to be safe and effective, you had what was called the Cutter incident, or the Cutter fiasco, where a vaccine produced by a laboratory in Berkeley, California, Cutter Labs, was found to be filled with live virus, and kids were coming down with polio from that vaccine. So right after being declared safe and effective, you have this awful incident where kids are getting polio from the vaccine that was just declared to be safe. And a lot of people stopped using the Salk vaccine, for at least for a year or two. And there were severe repercussions. What did happen with the Cutter vaccine, however, is that it really spurred federal involvement in sort of the testing and much better licensing procedures for vaccines in the future.
Yeah, and there was this terrible, one year, just a terrible outbreak in Boston. And, of course, the Sabin vaccine came along the next year. But this was really probably totally unnecessary. Had they not just been so haughty in Boston, of course. actually, I was a physician. I was an orthopedic surgeon. And of course, I knew the attitude in Boston. I mean, there are awful lot of smart people there. But, you can't think that nobody knows anything if you're not from Boston. And that was the attitude they had.
Uh-huh. Well, you would probably know that better than I. What I do know is that one of the greatest polio researchers, John Enders, was working, at Harvard at that time, and he was the only polio researcher to win the Nobel Prize. But as you say, Dr. Stan, he was a big supporter of Sabin, not of Salk.
And, of course, what a wonderful thing it was when we had no longer had these children getting crippled. I was, of course, brought up in the era where we had these children with all of the deformities, and the foot deformities, and the back deformities, and the paralyzed arms. And of course, only time I ever really saw them, after I got into practice was when I went to Africa, where, polio was still endemic. But one of the great accomplishments was just to end this horrible suffering for so many tragic young people.
Oh, I think that's absolutely right. I mean, it's one of the great medical triumphs of the 20th century, and what is really extraordinary about it is that it's a medical triumph brought about by voluntary association, by the American people banding together voluntarily. This was sort of the pre-government era, and it really is sort of the high point of people just deciding that their time and their money and their effort translate into the conquest of this horrific disease.
Well, what about Kaprowski? Because, of course, you write a good deal about Dr. Kaprowski, Hilary Kaprowski, and, of course, what part did he play in this?
Well, Hilary Kaprowski was a brilliant virologist and researcher, and he was working on a live virus oral polio vaccine, but he was not at a university, and he was not sponsored by the March of Dimes. He was working for a private company, and therefore he was sort of in some ways blackballed by the larger scientific community. But he formed his own, or he developed his own oral polio virus vaccine, and he tested it all over the world, in Ireland and Africa and parts of Latin America.
And was it as good as the Sabin vaccine?
That's a very tough question, because Sabin was so good at sort of getting politically what he wanted to get.
We're going to be back here in just a moment with David Osinski talking about his fascinating book on polio.
A
very important book is called AIDS, the Unnecessary Epidemic. Actually, it's a book I wrote back in 1991 that tells you the story of the politics of the AIDS epidemic and the fact that doctors have been blocked at every turn from doing what was really necessary to stop the spread of this horrible plague, both in the United States and throughout the world. AIDS, the Unnecessary Epidemic, it gives you my story of my effort working within organized medicine, the fact that the doctors of the state of California consistently voted and supported an effective public health policy, and at every turn their efforts were frustrated by those working within organized medicine, both at the state and national level, and the tragedy is that people are dying in America today unnecessarily. Call 1-800-5-HIV-WAR and ask for AIDS, the Unnecessary Epidemic, because you need to understand the background of this epidemic to understand what is really happening medically in America today.
This is health journalist Bill Sardi. In November of 1991, the 60 Minutes television show first reported on the French paradox, the fact the French violate every dietary rule for good health, eat a diet rich in fats and calories, and yet exhibit far better cardiovascular health than North Americans. Over a decade later, we know that molecules called polyphenols are responsible for the health benefits in red wine, but those molecules only remain stable in a sealed bottle of red wine. Longevinix is the first dietary supplement to stabilize red wine molecules in a sealed capsule, just like a corked bottle of red wine, providing red wine polyphenols without the calories, alcohol, and sulfite preservatives. One Longevinix capsule is equivalent in polyphenols to drinking 5 glasses of red wine. Call 866-405-4000 today to order Longevinix. It's a revolutionary dietary supplement. 866-405-4000.
Hi, this is Dr. Tony Thierry. Are you one of the many people who take vitamin supplements? Do you take handfuls of pills each day to increase energy, reduce your pain, or improve your overall health? Now there is a better way to get the vitamins and minerals your body needs in a delicious-tasting whole food liquid supplement, Body Balance. Body Balance contains 121 essential vitamins and minerals and is made from only organic and natural sources. Developed by doctors, Body Balance was originally available only through healthcare professionals. Now this incredible whole food liquid supplement can be delivered directly to your home. Body Balance offers an extremely effective method to feed your body towards wellness, and we're confident you'll love the difference your body feels. To order your Body Balance, call me directly at 1-800-768-9763 and try it risk-free for 45 days. Again, that's 1-800-768-9763. Or online at healthyfoundations.net.
Have you purchased or invested in gold and silver coins or bullion in the last several years? If so, you've most likely been taken advantage of. In a lot of cases, out and out lied to. There are several tricks of the trade in play in the precious metals and collector coin markets. This is especially true during a hot market. Although it doesn't take a savvy investor to avoid the pitfalls of unscrupulous coin and metals dealers, it does take some common sense and the knowledge of which questions to ask. The asset management professionals at Colonial Resources can arm you with a few simple questions to ask your current broker or coin dealer. To find out if you've been taken advantage of, or if you're thinking of investing, call Colonial Resources toll-free, 1-800-685-4042. The precious metals and collector coin markets are hot and definitely where the smart money is heading. But before you make a mistake that could cost you hundreds or even thousands of dollars, call the professionals at Colonial Resources. The call and the advice are free. 1-800-685-4042. That's 800-685-4042.
Well, this is Dr. Stan back here. Our guest this afternoon is David Oshinsky, and of course we're talking about his book, Polio, An American Story, and of course the background, of course, how this whole thing was actually done by mobilizing the people of America. It wasn't done by government. It wasn't done primarily by drug companies. It was done by concerned people who wanted to, of course, end this plague once and for all. Well, what's the great message that we can get from reading your book? Because, of course, this is the history of the end of one of the plagues that really had created so much havoc in our society.
That's a good question. I think the message for me is that this was a crusade in which there were no red states or blue states. It was a crusade in which virtually everybody pitched in. I remember my mother walking the streets in the march against polio. I remember collecting dimes as a kid. And we knew that the money was being put to good purpose, that a lot of the money, and they raised hundreds of millions of dollars.
Go right ahead, I'm sorry.
Okay, we knew that the money was being used to rehabilitate badly paralyzed kids, and we also knew that the money was being used for medical research. And in a sense, this medical research just revolutionized the way universities do research today. You know, using long-term grants, paying the indirect costs of universities for these grants, focusing research in ways that allowed scientists really to build on what others had done. It's just a remarkable story. And to me, Dr. Stan, it's the story of voluntarism, that voluntarism works.
And I think really there's a lot to be said for that. And here are people who are totally dedicated. They weren't in this to make a profit, at least not the scientists. They were there, of course, because they wanted to accomplish something for mankind. Now, of course, there was as poor as Jonas Sabin, certainly got a lot of publicity from the public, but wasn't there, of course, a lot of antagonism towards him by certain people within the academic community, and certainly by Albert Sabin? He didn't like Jonas, did he?
Well, I think that's true. You have to realize that Jonas Salk, for better or worse, became really the first celebrity scientist.
He sure did.
And by that I mean, you know, he had his picture on the cover of Time magazine. He went to the White House where President Eisenhower literally broke into tears as he thanked Salk for saving the children of America. Salk got the Congressional Medal of Freedom. So he was getting a level of publicity. He'd really become sort of the miracle worker in the white lab coat. And that just infuriated many scientists who believed that their role was to stay in the lab and to do their work and to avoid publicity and to remain anonymous. But Salk, it wasn't his fault to any great degree. This was just what America wanted. America wanted a hero at this time, and they got one. And Salk, I think, never, ever lived this down. And, you know, as I mentioned in my book, Dr. Stan, Salk amazingly is the only polio researcher of note not to be elected to the National Academy of Sciences, which is a scandal. He was essentially blackballed.
And, of course, it's such pettiness among our scientists. It's really a little infuriating, and yet they targeted him simply because he got so much notoriety, and he didn't do necessarily this. He wanted to help. He wanted to be the first one, but this was because he wanted to help the children, and they had to have a crash program to stop the polio.
That is absolutely right. And what the people at the March of Dimes saw in Jonas Salk, as one of them said, he sees beyond the microscope. In other words, he saw the suffering, and he realized that you might not have the best vaccine, but you have to have a vaccine that comes out quickly and that is safe. And that is really what Salk did. Salk understood, and the public was really beginning to demand a vaccine by this time, that really you had to give the public something. And he gave them something very, very good. And he just wasn't willing to wait years and years and years to have the perfect vaccine when 50,000 children annually were getting this disease.
Well, Chris, I can remember as well as you do. I'm a little older than you are, David, but I can remember my mother being terrified of this and my mother not letting me go to the swimming pool. And then, of course, I came down with a stiff neck, and I don't know whether it was a chicken pox, encephalitis, or polio, not to this very day, but I can remember going to the hospital and the fear that, you know, and the idea that there might be experimental vaccines that would help. And my folks were very, very poor, but they would have put out any amount of money to save me for the scourge.
I think we have identical memories.
Right. And, of course, it really is an amazing, amazing story, having lived through this and then having seen this disease completely disappear. So, well, we're going to be back here in just a moment or two for David. He's going to be able to stay with us for about 15 minutes more. And when we get back, of course, we're going to welcome your calls at 1-888-24-LIBERTY. That's 1-888-24-LIBERTY. Or here in the Central Coast of California at 464-8295. This is an important part of our history. It's a great story of really the finding of the poliovirus and what we did.
really help you to understand the nature of the spiritual battle in which we're currently involved is Gary Kaw's book, The Demonic Roots of Globalism. Now, you may remember Gary Kaw's book, A Route to Global Occupation. His second book, The Demonic Roots of Globalism, goes into the very real spiritual forces, the dark and sinister spiritual forces, which have energized those people who are molding the world in which we live today. Going into the background of Masonry, Theosophy, and he actually quotes extensively from the writings of these people who have helped to mold the events of the 20th century. The Demonic Roots of Globalism by Gary Kaw will give you tremendous insight into the background of what's happening in America today, and unless you understand the spiritual forces at work, you really can't understand the unfolding of events. Call 1-800-5-HIV-WAR and ask for The Demonic Roots of Globalism by Gary Kaw.
If you're looking for a residential care home in the Morgan Hill-Gilroy region, consider Morgan Hill Manor. The facility has private and semi-private rooms, 24-hour supervision, licensed vocational nurses, special diets, help with the activities of daily living, recreational activities, housekeeping, transportation for medical visits, television, private phones, internet access, personal laundry, hairdressing, and many other services. Morgan Hill Manor is hosting an open house at 17090 Peak Avenue in Morgan Hill from 2 to 6 p.m. on Thursday, May 12th. That's 17090 Peak Avenue in Morgan Hill from 2 to 6 p.m. on May 12th. If you can't attend, call Elsie or Gene at 408-778-9544. That's 408-778-9544 and request a brochure or additional information.
Cutting-edge dentists know the profound effect dental materials and procedures have on the health of the entire body. If you've been searching for a holistic trained dentist who can safely treat you, look no further. Dr. David Biles has been a leader in the Santa Cruz dental community for nearly 20 years. He built a solid reputation providing exceptionally high-quality cosmetic and restorative dental care long before learning the very real hazards of common dental practices. Now, as a faculty member of the Institute of Natural Dentistry, Dr. Biles has begun lecturing nationally to other dentists on alternative and complementary dental care. On request, Dr. Biles will safely remove toxic dental materials from your mouth while substituting them with safe, non-allergenic restorations. Call Dr. Biles today and take the next step to improve your health. With sedation and nitrous oxide available, Dr. Biles can help even the most anxious patients. Call 423-0121 and schedule a visit now. That's 423-0121.
Well, this is Dr. Stan back here at Radio Liberty. Our guest this afternoon is David Osinski. We're talking about his book, Polio, An American Story. And, of course, it goes into a lot. There are all sorts of various intricacies of this incredible story and the personalities who are, of course, are the heroes and or maybe villains of the story, but really heroes of the story, Jonas Salk and certain Albert Sabin and Hilary Kaprowski. And, of course, you even go into the fact that the FBI was investigating Sabin at the time. What was that about?
Jonas Salk. Jonas Salk, as a young man, had been involved in left-wing activities for a relatively brief time in the 1930s during the Great Depression, which was not uncommon at that time. And then he pretty well left them and went on to his medical career. But when he applied for a security clearance to work for the Surgeon General on a commission, the FBI had to do an investigation at that time, a federal loyalty security investigation, and it found this material, and two full-field FBI investigations were done on Salk, and it was really touch and go, and I don't know, Dr. Stan, how much Salk or his family actually knew about this. In the end, the Surgeon General cleared him on loyalty, and I think it was a pretty close case, because this was the at the height of the Cold War when he was being investigated. And had he not gotten his security clearance, I think the March of Dimes would have dropped him because they were very, very image conscious. And someone else's name would have been on that vaccine, but not Salk's.
Well, of course, there were many, many aspects of this entire incredible story. And of course, once this, of course, had been secured here in the United States and accepted in the United States, then, of course, it was introduced to the rest of the world, wasn't it?
I'm sorry, say that again.
No, I'm just saying that once, of course, we had started inoculating people in the United States, mm-hmm. we started inoculating people throughout the rest of the world.
Well, we did, and what has happened, which is really remarkable, as I'm sure you know, is that the March of Dimes, once polio was quote-unquote conquered, in other words, once these two successful vaccines were out, the March of Dimes moved on, and they moved on to birth defects. But Rotary International has sort of taken up the cause of vaccination around the world, particularly polio vaccination, and they have spent hundreds of millions of dollars vaccinating children in the third world, Africa, Pakistan, India, and they've just been incredible in moving this forward. We're not quite there yet, but and as you may know, you know, vaccination is a very tricky issue, and you know, getting some people vaccinated, there's, particularly in the Muslim areas of the world, there are rumors always fly that, you know, the polio vaccine is a Western plot to make their women sterile or to cause AIDS, and it's been vaccination. There's a lot of cultural resistance to it in parts of the world, and that has really kept polio from being wiped off the face of the earth. It's pretty well wiped off the face of the United States, but not the earth itself. And Rotary International is doing a great job.
All right, fine. Well, of course, what was the main thing that you learned after, you know, because every time you study an issue, well, you certainly get an entirely different perspective of it than when you start out. I know when I'm researching any subjects, it's amazing all the things that you come up with and all the intricacies. What's the major thing you've learned from your study of the polio epidemic and, of course, the polio vaccine?
Well, I think the major thing I learned was that you can have voluntary organizations like the March of Dimes, which will revolutionize the way philanthropy is done, the way medical research is done, the way medical testing is done. In other words, it all doesn't have to come from the government. And that, I think, was what, when you look at, you know, until the March of Dimes came along, the average philanthropy would just have 2 or 3 millionaires who would throw money at a problem, and the March of Dimes just turned it on its head to ask for small contributions from tens of millions of Americans, and it worked. And then the March of Dimes got together the most ambitious, aggressive researchers and put their heads together and forced them to face the problem in a common way. And it gave out money in that direction to the best of them. And it really, what I learned, Dr. Stan, is that this was an issue both of participation and of quality. And in the 1950s, which was one of the great eras, I think, in American history, all of this came together and it worked. And I'm hoping we'll have eras like that again. I'm not sure we will, but I'm hoping we will.
We can always hope for the best. Look, one of the things you point out, first of all, this was a disease much more prevalent in the very civilized societies where, we had much better hygiene. It was a disease primarily in the summertime. It was a seasonal disease. Was it more in boys than in girls?
That's a very good accent. It was, in fact, and we don't know why. The most common theory, it was more common in boys and girls, and the most common theory is that in that era, boys played harder than girls did. And as you know, a lot of sort of fighting off the polio virus had to do with your immune system and resistance. And the feeling was that boys just would, you know, they'd get it in equal numbers, but boys sort of wore their bodies down and were more likely to get it. Why it came in the summer? The best guess we have is that, you know, it really is a disease that goes through the digestive tract. And those are more common in hot weather months than respiratory infections, which tend to come in cold weather months. Again, just a guess. And as you mentioned, when you talk about sanitation, it appeared that the cleaner and more sanitized the United States became, the more likely kids were to get polio.
And could you explain why? Because I think that's really such an important issue.
Well, you know, dirt and disease are not often mutually exclusive. We tend to think that dirty societies or societies that do not have good cleanliness have more disease. But in some cases, it actually toughens your immune system and builds up immunity to disease. And the only really major polio epidemics occurred in the 20th century in Western countries that were industrializing, had good public health measures, We're beginning to use all kinds of disinfectants and the like. And generally, you know, the average kid in America may have been exposed to poliovirus as an infant and had maternal antibodies that would protect it. But now, because of sanitation, the average kid didn't come across poliovirus till he was 3 or 4 or 5 and really had no immunity and no antibodies to the disease.
And I think that was really such an interesting point. The other thing is that, you know, the post-polio weakness that sometimes people who've had polio later on will, of course, develop progressive weakness. That was something I really wasn't aware of, even as a physician. Because it sort of developed that idea. I thought that was quite revealing to me.
Well, what has happened, Dr. Stan, is that 40 years later, you know, people who got polio and at the age of 10 in the 1940s or 50s are getting all the symptoms again, particularly terrible muscle weakness and feelings of paralysis in outer limbs. And it's clearly not that the virus has reemerged in them, but what appears to happen is that once you got polio as a young child, you would, the nerve endings that weren't killed off or weren't paralyzed, and the muscles that weren't paralyzed, would take on the work of those that were. And over the years, the body just has worn out. In other words, polio patients work so hard with the muscles and the nerves that they have that after a period of years, they just, you know, it's like an 8-cylinder car working on 4 cylinders, and sooner or later it's going to wear down. And there appear to be, you know, hundreds of thousands of polio survivors now who have come down with what appears to be the same symptoms, tragically, 40 years later, and that's now called post-polio syndrome.
And I really thought that's so interesting. I can remember polio patients that, you know, were able to go out and go hunting, and then maybe when they got to be 45 years old, suddenly they couldn't do it anymore because their legs were getting progressively weaker, and I'm sure it's absolutely that. And now, of course, they were beginning to lose that increased strength that they've been able to create, you know, during the more active years.
You hit it on the nose. That is exactly right. That is exactly right.
Well, I know you have to be going. Is there
I do. I'm going to a lecture at the university in about half an hour and a half to prepare for it.
All right. Do you have any parting thoughts you'd like to leave for our listeners, other than they should get your book, Polio?
Yes, that's first. Thank you.
How can they get that?
And they can get it by going to, you know, your local bookstore. Barnes & Noble has it. Amazon has it, you know, on the web. Borders has it. Hopefully you have local bookstores there that are thriving, and they will have it. And it's put out by Oxford University Press, and I think it's a really good read. And the other I have, Dr. Stan, is just, you know, as best you can, read all the literature, but vaccinate your children. Talk to your pediatrician, but vaccinate your children, particularly against polio.
All right.
It's only a plane ride away.
All right, fine. Thanks very much. Really appreciate you being with
Thank
us.
Thank you, Dr. Stan.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Okay, fine. That was David Oshinsky, and then our telephone number, if you'd like to call us, is 1-888-24-LIBERTY. That's 1-888-24-LIBERTY. Or here in the Central Coast of California at 464-8295. And I will have to admit that the polio vaccination was one of the great strides of our time. The problem was that there were a number of problems. The first one was that when they put out the original Sabin vaccine, and it was tested by a woman named Bernice Eddy, and you'll find this in a book actually put out by the National Institute of Health, or sponsored by it, called The Health Century. Dr. Bernice Eddy found out that the Qatar vaccine contained live polioviruses, and they were killing monkeys. So she told her superiors, and for some incredible, unknown, unexplainable reason, they released that polio vaccine, the Qatar vaccine, and it started killing people. Why would you do something that stupid unintentionally? Then, of course, when sometime later, Dr. Bernice Eddy discovered that there was a cancer-producing virus in there, SV40, why, of course, she announced that, and she was, of course, shunned. She was punished in the National Institute of Health. Hillerman, I believe his name was, at the Merck lab, found exactly what she had found. And then, of course, they could not tell the American people. Now, of course, it said that the simian virus 40 doesn't produce cancer. Well, there is no evidence it doesn't produce cancer. They can't produce. They find all these new cancers that have never been there before, mesotheliomas, and they've all got this in there. They know that if you inject it into animals, it'll produce cancer, but they cannot tell the American people that. because we would lose confidence in our vaccines. Now, I'm not saying that you should not get polio vaccination. I think that now that they're offering the Sabin vaccine, and of course they beefed it up and they've actually done a pretty good job with that, that it's not a good thing to take. But I'm against many of the vaccines, any vaccine that has mercury in it or many of the other preservatives. Let's go to Roger, who's waiting patiently on the line. Roger, go ahead.
Oh, that's fine. Yeah, I you may recall that it was probably just over a year ago I bounced this question off you and a guest. It's kind of a monkey wrench question. It was some 5 years back. I recall an interview with a woman talking her book on the Christian talk radio circuit, a doctor, and her claim was that the only difference being the number of days to determination of a subset of the symptoms that, and I'm reaching a little, I think it was one of the meningitis forms she claimed was the exact same microbe as polio.
Well, I think that she can claim anything on especially on talk radio, but polio was very, very specific because it attacked the anterior horn cells, and although it did produce a meningoencephalitis, it produced peripheral paralysis, and I don't believe that the polio exists in our country except in very rare cases. But if you can say anything you want to on a talk radio, this is going to be contested.
Well, I thought maybe you had a more updated refutation of the claim, but maybe somebody sent you something or whatever.
I'm going to be like that unidentifiable source who declined to be quoted who said he had no comment.
God bless.
God bless. Okay, let's go to, when I get our telephone number, is 1-888-24-LIBERTY or 464-8295. Now, the next thing, which of course we never mention, is that when, of course, they found that there was a simian virus 40 in the original polio vaccine, incredibly, they did not stop giving it. They did not want the American people to know that there was a potential cancer-producing virus, so they simply used up their supplies and infected countless millions of people in the United States and throughout the world with a cancer-producing virus. Simian virus 40 is the most carcinogenic virus known. This was the first cancer virus that we ever found. And isn't it amazing that nobody ever talks about it? We do carry the book, The Virus and the Vaccine. Dr. Caboni has done a great deal of work, tested many of tumors, and found they contain this virus. And, of course, people say, well, you can't prove it produces it. You can't prove that smoking tobacco produces lung cancer either. You can't produce it. Or that asbestos produces mesotheliomas just because you find it in there. And the tumor doesn't mean that it produces it. But they know it is, and I fear we're being lied to once again. Anyway, when they changed from the rhesus monkey to the simian virus, from the rhesus monkey to the green monkey, and then we started getting all the monkey cytomegalic viruses, and the trouble was they rushed these things out of the market without adequate testing, and heaven only knows what complications there are down the line. Well, let's go to Linda, who's calling us from Washington. Hi, Linda.
Hello, Dr. Stan. I just wanted to make a comment. I don't believe in the polio vaccine. My brother in the 20s was 9 years old. He was born in the 20s, and at the age of 9, he contracted polio. Not from the polio vaccine, but it was very devastating. He's about 74 years old now, and what this doctor was talking about, the polio pulse syndrome, that came upon him, and he can no longer walk anymore. But it was Sister Kenny who came to Minneapolis, and he was among some of the first patients that she had, and she was able to help a lot of polio victims with her hot packs and such. But then in the mid-60s, when I was still living in Minneapolis, this apartment I lived in, there was a young woman there that we were the same age. She took the polio vaccine, and right after she took it, she contracted polio, and she had the very worst kind you can get. She was a total paraplegic. And I remember going to school one day with one of my friends, and we paid 25 cents for the polio vaccine. It came in a little paper cup. And I think you were supposed to take three different shots of it, or, you know, I don't even remember if it was a liquid or a pill, what it was.
They used to give it a sugar cube.
Yeah, okay, that's this. What it was.
Three drops of three different strains of the polio.
Well, I only took the one, and my friend who had all three, she died at around the age of 59 with a sudden, well, they said that they don't even know what happened to her, but she just suddenly died. And I don't know, I just, I don't believe in any of these vaccinations anymore. I don't trust any of these doctors.
Well, the average doctor is an honest person, but of course there are some wicked and evil people out there, and that's what we really have to be worried about. In other words, the average doctor would never hurt you, but there are some wicked people who would. And some of them, of course, wear white coats, and they work in our scientific laboratories. And, of course, they're dedicated to limiting the population of the world. Hey, well, we're out of time. God bless. Thanks so much for being with us.
The Anglo-American establishment gives you the documentation for Professor Quigley's allegation that there was a secret society created in England that ultimately came to dominate England and ultimately came to dominate the United States of America. The Anglo-American establishment will give you the books that you can read, written by men who were actually involved in the original secret society. Professor Quigley opens his book saying that most people have heard of the Rhodes Scholarships, and most people, a few people, have actually heard that Cecil Rhodes wrote a confession of faith, which was attached to his first five wills, talking about the formation of a secret society. But what almost no one in America realizes today is that that secret society was actually formed and still exists to this very day. The Anglo-American Establishment by Professor Quigley, Bill Clinton's mentor, is one of the most important books you'll ever read, and available by calling 1-800-5-HIV-WAR.
Have you ever wondered whether you're really getting the truth from the media? Have you ever thought that maybe somebody's controlling your reality? Well, there's going to be a meeting. It's going to be held at the Westin Hotel over by Great America. It's going to be on May 28th and 29th, and it's going to be at the Conspiracy Conference. Now, if you'd like to know more about the Conspiracy Conference, call 209-832-0999. That's 209-832-0999. This is the fifth exciting year they've had this. Dick Gregory's going to be there, Nick Begich. There's going to be Daniel Hopsicker, Jack McLam. I'm going to have a booth, although I'll not be speaking. You're going to see really the contrast between good and evil. The Conspiracy Conference is a great educational opportunity. We hope that many of you will give serious consideration to going May 28th, 29th. That's 209-832-0999. That's 209-832-0999.
Are you concerned about your child's future? Well, it starts with a sound education. VHM provides for that cornerstone of your child's future with a quality education founded on biblical principles. Our school sets high academic goals while developing moral standards. From preschool through eighth grade, your child is taught by experienced and credentialed teachers in all subjects, including our dynamic music program and state-of-the-art computer classes. Proverbs 22:6 says, "Train up a child in the way he should go, and when he is old, he will not depart from it." For over 50 years, VHM Christian School has provided peace of mind to parents knowing their children are receiving an excellent education in a loving environment. VHM is located at 427 Capitola Road Extension in Santa Cruz. Won't you call us today at 475-4762? That's VHM Christian School at 475-4762. Doesn't your child deserve a chance to try VHM?
Well, this is Dr. Stan back here at Radio Liberty. And, of course, I think that they have got the simian virus 40 out of the vaccine, out of the polio vaccine, but they can't tell the American people the truth. We carry the book, The Virus and the Vaccine, a well-documented book about the simian virus and its cover-up. And now, of course, you can read even more about that in the book. We don't carry it, but it's called The Health Century. It was actually sponsored by the National Institute of Health, written by Edward Shorter. You may be able to get a copy from the library or up on the Internet. And it tells this whole sordid story and the conscious effort to deceive the American people after that, saying, well, they're not really smart enough to understand this. Why they would lose confidence in the physicians. Then, of course, you need to get the book Evidence of Harm, which goes into the mercury that was in the vaccines. It supposedly has been taken out of most of the vaccines now. Of course, they left it in the influenza vaccine for absolutely no reason whatsoever. And then they told us to give it to our six-month-old children and our elderly people, knowing full well the destructive element on the binds. And if you doubt that, if you'd like to get the article from Dr. Fudenberg's website, and he is the dean of vaccinologists in America, and certainly the most revered of all vaccinologists, we'll be glad to send you the abstract from his webpage, where he points out that if you are foolish enough to take the influenza vaccine, and you're between 60 and 65, and you take it for three or four times over a five-year period, your incidence of Alzheimer's disease goes up tenfold, 1,000%. But you're not going to hear that, and your doctor doesn't know that, and you need to go to his website or give us a call at 1-800-544, and we'll get you that information. But you need to get the book, on the evidence of harm going into the mercury, which produced so much tragedy, and one out of every six American children has a neurodevelopmental or a behavioral abnormality, and many of these are directly related to the poison that they gave our children for so many years, and some people knew exactly what they were doing. For as George Bernard Shaw said, by diet and injections and injunctions, we can mold the character of our children. Page 50 of his book, The Impact of Science on Society, and that will be included in our new syllabus, which we're going to be making available, because we got permission from the publisher to use those pages in our new syllabus called The Hidden Agenda. So that'll be available. Of course, that really goes into the background of water fluoridation. We have four tape sets on mercury. We have a video on mercury, and then, of course, we have the new book, Evidence of Harm. You need to get this information. You need to know, would they really do something to harm our children, to hurt people and put them in the vaccines? And the answer is yes. I had the opportunity attending a meeting of population control research organizations, a Catholic group, and of course talked to doctors from both the Philippines and Kenya, where they actually put contraceptive material into the vaccines so women could not conceive children. I had one of the leading vaccine experts in the country on our radio program, and when I brought up this subject, he immediately hung up in the middle of the program. Gee, I wonder why. Well, I didn't say that it was true. I just asked him what he knew about it, if he knew anything about it. Of course, the elite know about this sort of thing. We have the book, which we quote in our latest talk, The Hidden Agenda. It came out in 1963, the SIBA Symposium, where they got all the intellectuals together in something called Man and His Future, and they talked about what they were going to put in our food and in our salt and in our water to control fertility, because they don't want us to have children, because they're so much smarter than we are. Would they put things in our vaccines? Certainly they'd put things in our vaccines, but they don't want you to know. You need to get our four tape set on vaccinations. Some vaccinations are good, and some of them are potentially dangerous, and you need to be able to know the difference between them. And then, of course, remember our number, 1-800-544-8927. 1-800-544-8927. I think polio vaccine was one of the greatest things of all time. But I think, of course, that the mercury in the vaccines, not in the polio vaccines, but the other, has produced terrible, terrible problems in our society. And they're simply lying and concealing these things from the American people. Pray for Radio Liberty. Pray for our provision and protection until tomorrow. May the Lord be with you.